Once again, that's feedback@edandethan.com. Ready for panel, Ed?
Ready, let's go.
Woohoo! All right, this is Ed and Ethan.
Travel around this land of Oz, one thought comes back to me again and again. These people are nuts!
Reminds me, Ed, of some of your family members when I'm talking to them about private roads. No,
what? All right. Well.
So, of course, we're going to start out today with panel. Panel, not start out today. We're going to continue today with panel. What am I thinking? Check out edandethan.com for the latest updates for... and eventually, we're going to get that into a shiny, new, spazzy website.
Yes, it's coming. It's
Did
in
I say
work.
Spazzy? I meant jazzy.
Spazzy jazzy.
Spazzy if you're designing it, right?
Sure.
Also, thank you to LRN.FM for putting us on their podcast loop. It's a pleasure to be there. So on panel today with talented voices everywhere, of course, we've got Jared LaChance returning from Winnipeg, Manitoba. It's a pleasure to have Jared back on. It's been far too long. A friend of the show and, I say, noted raconteur. Jared, thanks for coming on today.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Also, Nima Vedati from Austin, Texas, one half of the widely popular Freedom Fiends podcast. He joins us today as well to add his enlightened view or voice to panel. Nima, thank you very much for coming on today as well.
Very glad to be here, my friendly fellows of the North.
Fellows of the North. Shivering and cold, but of course, always heated by the passion that comes with liberty.
Internal warming.
Yeah.
Works quite well.
Okay, so let's start. Let's dive right in. This is a story that I've been hearing a lot about lately, and what I've been hearing has not been meshing with what I think is really the proper framing for this. Now, two Australian DJs called a hospital in the UK where Kate Middleton, the Royal Princess, was being treated for acute morning sickness. They managed to bluff their way past the switchboard operator to the duty nurse and imitate Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth.
Nice.
They then also managed to get personal information about Kate Middleton from the duty nurse, who then later killed herself after this prank call was aired on Australian radio. Now, despite the fact that there has been no link to connect the two events conclusively, this has been the assumption of people that these two DJs are essentially the cause of this woman's suicide, or what appears to be a suicide. So I'm curious, panelists, what you guys think. I'll start off with you, Nima. Do you think that this was the DJ's fault, the radio presenter's fault in Australia? What's your take?
Well, what I'm beginning to think now is maybe it's just a revenge prank on the part of the hospital. Like, hey, you think you got us? What about this, guys?
Oh, wow. Talk about doing revenge prank to the extreme.
I could only hope so, right? Because then at least one person wouldn't be dead. But, you know, I don't think there's any fault on the act or on the part of the radio DJs. They're just doing what radio DJs have done forever and will continue to do forever. I mean, impersonating the Queen of England, isn't that like the oldest prank call in the book? Like, don't little 5-year-old kids do that? It seems to me the only person that did anything wrong was the nurse made a little faux pas and mistake by handing out information that she shouldn't have. Yeah, she did commit suicide, and that is sad. But A, there's no causality, at least none that's come out yet. And B, it doesn't change the actions of the prank callers, right? It's like if I committed suicide after the mailman delivered me a nasty letter from my ex, blood wouldn't be on the postman's hands, would it? Well, at least not that way.
Well, I mean, that's the odd perception, isn't it? Is that people think somehow that the DJs caused somebody's self-inflicted death. I don't make the connection. Jared, do you see a connection here to the DJs? Do you think that they had an influence on this woman's death from what you can see?
I don't think they had an influence on it. No, it is very devastating that she had done it. And I kind of question why she did it. Like, basically, did she fear like reprisal from the prince and the princess in case she did do something wrong and they decided that it was her fault? Maybe she just maybe she panicked and just. Like, basically, like I said, she feared reprisal from the crown, so
But that's it, isn't
or maybe
it? All,
she just...
all of this is speculation. We don't really mm-hmm. know. And what's really disturbing to me here about this is that the public sphere across the planet has taken to condemning these Australian DJs. So we're kind of, it seems like there's a mass reaction to what can only be detailed as uncertainty. I don't see any sort of solid, concrete reason, a logical reason for any sort of action.
There
here.
Was a Facebook page that was set up to condemn the DJs. Right. And it seems like it's just all out of this emotion that people have. And they're not basing anything on actual fact, just on hearsay by the media.
Is there any evidence of the demographics of this? Like, is this just you crazy Commonwealthers, or is this Americans and people
Americans
in other countries
are pretty
too?
Up on it, too. You know, there are people from all over the world are condemning these DJs for, you know, what they've done, which was make a phone call and make a prank call. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And did the nurse didn't give out anything damning to the queen or the royal family from what I've heard, did she? It was just like basic stuff, like stuff that wasn't horrible to say on air, right? Am I wrong in that?
Right. Yes, you are correct in that. So it doesn't seem like there was any specific damning, horrible information that was released to the public. It was just, well, I mean, you know, it was information that was applicable to anybody dealing with pregnancy, really. And everybody already knew that, of course, Kate Middleton is expecting. So nothing there's nothing. Something here just really doesn't make sense to me. I'm really not sure exactly how it is we're supposed to be driven to saying that these DJs are the worst, awful people ever. Actually, you know what? Here's a question. Do you guys think that maybe the DJs themselves have been affected very negatively by this? Because the Australian broadcasting company that employs them is saying this. Nima, do you think that this sort of event may have had a rather nasty negative impact on the DJs?
I think it's very possible. I mean, I don't really know the personality of them. And even if you do know that you didn't do anything wrong, sometimes you can still feel guilty. You know, even if I did it, and I'm very in the pro DJ camp here, I don't think they did anything wrong. I think they're just doing their job. But even without doing anything immoral, not like a Nuremberg just doing their job, following orders kind of thing. They were just doing what radio DJs are supposed to do. But even if I were in their shoes, I still might feel kind of uneasy about it. I would want to know more, though. That would be my first step. Whenever I feel icky about something, my first step is to try to find out more. And I think the sad part is that I think all of us on the panel sort of agree that it's kind of silly for the public to be saying there's blood on the DJ's hands. That I think that's taking it a little bit too far. So then to me, the question becomes why? Why is there this sort of mob mentality? It almost reminds me of a South Park episode, like the level at which this has been blown out of proportion, like somebody is going to outlaw calling people on the phone at all or something very out of hand and ridiculous like that.
Right. Well, the Australian, what was it? The ACMA. It's the Media Control Authority. Equivalent to the CRTC in Canada, or the FCC in the United States for Nima's benefit here. But they've come down on this, saying, well, you know, we're going to be looking into this. So here's another problem: is it looks like this is going to have a massive effect on Australian media potentially in regards to regulation. Jared, do you see the same sort of fallout maybe coming in Australia?
I see that kind of follow coming probably anywhere that, especially the royals traveling, and anywhere within the Commonwealth states there for sure. There'll be do not say this, do not say, if somebody calls asking about this, then yeah, totally. I see that it affecting it quite a bit there.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, right? Regulation is very reactionary in many cases. And so you get this instance of humanity that is a prank call possibly going wrong. We don't even know. I'm really sure. But the reaction from the bureaucracy is typically, we have to change how society works so this doesn't happen again.
It sounds very typical of government. Hey, there's a crisis going on. We need to solve this problem because there's a crisis.
Right.
And take advantage of it, because
and crisis
we're the government
can often be just one thing. Actually, what was it? Australia had an incident many years ago with somebody firing a high-powered rifle or some such thing from a large tower. He killed off a lot of people, and that was a major event that pushed gun control in Australia. Mm-hmm. That's another discussion. But what I'm saying is, you know, this is how bureaucracy reacts. If something goes wrong, the solution is seemingly, let's just change how everything works in society because we can do that.
Let's soothe people's emotions in the moment.
Soothe people's emotions in the moment, but also really change how society works. Change all of the natural mm-hmm. signals and say, don't address the problem, the core root problem. Why did somebody kill themselves? What really caused this to happen? The reaction is, let's stop the sniffles, not the cold.
Yeah.
Let's apply more Kleenex, right?
Sounds about right.
So, Nima, would you agree?
I agree completely. And I think you're right to point out that the state is really the culprit here. I mean, it's sad that the public has this sort of mob mentality and is taking this reactionary approach. But we wouldn't really think much of it if there wasn't a state apparatus for them to get a hold of, for them to convince, right? In a free society, in the absence of a state apparatus for the mob to do something crazy, all they could really do is bitch and moan on the internet.
Yeah,
right. And people do that anyway. So I think the problem is really the state here. Like you said, the regulatory bodies are already looking into it. And once they do that, they kind of have to take some kind of step. Hopefully it's a minimal step or just some kind of chide to the radio station or the DJs. But yeah, you're right. It could be something to where they do try to change the way the world works. Of course, it's nothing but a try to change, right? They can never actually change human nature. They can only impose their own arbitrary restrictions on it, which just makes life harder for everybody.
Right. Yeah, no, it's just disruption in natural markets. It's the same story every time. Let's move on to something that really did shock me. I'm not really sure exactly how to think of this. I'll need your guys' input on this one. In Quebec, there's a 13-year-old boy. He's been charged with attempted murder. Essentially, what happened is there was a 13-year-old girl at a friend's home, this 13-year-old boy. She was reported missing. The police found this very odd, suspicious, you know, a girl with good grades in school, somebody not seen as typical of just up and running away.
Yeah.
She returned to her home as police were there trying to figure out where she had gone. She showed up missing some articles of clothing, also badly injured, apparently. Mm-hmm. There's no the injuries that she had weren't specified. And as a result, police are apparently, they look to this 13-year-old boy and now charge him with aggravated sexual assault and attempted murder. This is very disturbing to me because it's a 13-year-old. To me, that's a young person. So how does or how should society deal with a 13-year-old who undertakes violent action against another youth? Anima, I'm going to start with you again. What do you think should be the course of action here? What seems sensible to you?
Well, I guess we should take it in a theoretical sense here.
Yes.
But first, I do want to note that there wasn't a whole lot of information, like you say, on what the actual injuries were, what happened, what the series of events was, why they went so far as to take the attempted murder charge. Because with the charge that serious, I feel like you have to have some really serious evidence. And your general public will trust somebody like a public prosecutor and be like, oh, well, he must know what he's talking about. But I don't give prosecutors that same quarter because I've seen and read about prosecutors doing some very nasty, evil things to further their own careers, regardless of the facts of a case. But in a theoretical society, I suppose there has to be justice. And justice, you know, I don't suppose that there actually does have to be justice. And to me, justice comes most true from the victim's heart. So what has to happen is the criminal or the perpetrator has to somehow make things right. They have to repair whatever happened, and and make it right with the victim. In this case, where the victim's also 13, though, it's really hard to understand how that would happen. I think in a free society, the families would get involved, the parents would get involved, and I would imagine there would have to be some type of third party, although, you know, that third party, there's nothing that says it has to be a violent monopoly we call the state. The third party could easily be a trusted arbitrator or a trusted member of the community, somebody that's upstanding and that everybody trusts to sort of help these kids deal with what happened and make it to where both parties are okay. I mean, I hope the 13-year-old boy feels some kind of remorse, and it's going to be in his best interest for his own brain and his own heart to make things right with the victim. I mean, that sounds kind of like kumbaya, my lord, but I think it's part of nature that he would have some kind of feelings like that. If not, he's a sociopath, and you know, the arbitrator and the community members would understand that too, and find some kind of different course of action to take.
So, Jared, Nima talks about a restorative justice. With that in mind, where do you come down on this?
Well, I come down on the where we are right now with the way everything is. I'm very much fearing that, like Nima said, without knowing all of the facts behind the case, I would be very much fearing that they're going to try him as an adult and then put him, like, lock him away with other sociopaths and people that shouldn't be, that, you know what I mean? Somebody that's going to be teaching him more horrible things, basically, and how to perfect his craft. So something like that, yeah. But I really do believe in the restorative justice, and that in that sense, that would deter a lot of people after a while. You know what I mean? Like, once people see that this is happening, that committing crime, you'll now have to work for it, and you'll have to understand, like, bring you to understand why you've done it and how it's going to, like, how it affects
the
victims.
Restorative justice would bring true remedy, right? Right now, our solution in contemporary society today is to lock people away.
And have the victim pay for them to live there. That pisses me off.
Right.
It's an odd solution. But, I mean, it's an emotional reaction to a serious problem. I mean, if we speak about this situation in theoretical terms, you know, if we knew more about this, it seems that this would be a crime that emotionally would be...
Ethan, nowhere is anything mentioned about the parents of this 13-year-old child who did these horrible acts.
That's true.
Supposed horrible acts.
Alleged horrible acts, yeah.
That's where it comes down to, where the heck are the parents?
Right.
How do you allow this to happen?
That's part of our emotional response to situations like this. It's not to involve... Like, in Saskatchewan here, we with a large Aboriginal population, we sometimes can find incredibly emotional commentary on the illegitimacy of sentencing circles, the idea that the community should come around and get together and discuss what sort of justice should be meted out for a person that has been convicted of some sort of crime.
Mm-hmm.
So people really hate this idea, people getting around together to talk about how do we repair our community. Because I think the emotional reaction is a lot easier. The emotional reaction is, let's just throw this bastard in prison. Mm-hmm. Let's get rid of them, separate them from society. But that's not restorative. That doesn't help anybody repair the damage of a situation.
It's fast food justice, right? It's quick, it's easy, but it doesn't make anything better. It's unhealthy.
It's the illusion of it making things better or fixing the problem, but it's, again, just stuffing it under the rug for later. Go ahead.
Here's something I wanted for us to chew on, too, and my wife brought this up. In our sort of scenario, in our fantasies about restorative justice, and the victim, you know, helping to decide how that justice goes, what happens when the victim is a very forgiving person? Do they open themselves up to more attacks on themselves? My wife posited that question to me, and I wondered if we could maybe talk about that, because is that a flaw? And my initial response was, well, it seems like the market would naturally take care of that, in the sense that if you are a very forgiving person, you will get less and less so the more people aggress on you. The first time, you know, you forgive somebody for punching you in the face, yeah, that's fine. The second time, maybe not so much. The third time, you're probably going to punch the guy back.
Well, not only that, but look, I mean, if we're speaking about a society that values reputation, and a free society has to value reputation, a forgiving person will likely be known as a forgiving person and likely open themselves up to greater opportunity in social circumstance. So, I mean, this is a balance that we're talking about. If you are a forgiving person and you do open yourself up, I have experience with it. I don't mean to be immodest, but I have experience with terrible business deals gone awry because of a handshake. I accept that I've done ill to myself and my personal finances as a result. And I don't know. It seems that that's just kind of a facet of my life that I have to deal with and is balanced by how people interact with me. So I don't know. I think a forgiving person might not necessarily become a victim in society. I don't think that's how that would work. Jared, what does this bring to mind for you? Nice people.
Nice people are great. And people that want to do things right away. But with having people that forgive really easily, they would show compassion, and that compassion would spread throughout the people because, you know, somebody who did somebody wrong, and then they would be constantly thinking about why this person let them off so easy. Like, why were they so compassionate towards them? And then that would carry forth. And then if you had a restorative justice type system for a long enough period of time, you would slowly breed out random acts and a lot of these sociopathic things. That's what I believe. Mm-hmm.
Interaction that's voluntary and also beneficial and friendly is valued, right? I'm just coming back to how this all balances against itself. And so people who are nice people naturally should have more opportunity for social interaction because they're known as nice people. Nima, do you buy that?
Yeah, I buy that. I mean, if you're a nice person, if you're a very forgiving person, then your neighbors and the people you do business with are going to apply more pressure to anybody who would victimize you. The victimizer would have to contend with more social ostracism in the case of attacking a more forgiving, more upstanding, generally considered nicer person in society. I also am curious, you mentioned an Aboriginal population and community circles. I'm sorry, we don't get much news from Saskatchewan in the States, but I'm curious, could you explain how that sort of works? Is that a nice model for you guys to look at? And it seems like it must be time tested.
I think there are certain qualities of it that are nice. I mean, there are problems. First off, sentencing circles are often government imposed through government courts. But I like the idea. As I said, there are certain good qualities. The base idea is that if somebody undertakes a crime, it can even be a violent crime.
I think it's mainly within the community is where it's focused. Yeah,
right. It's a gathering of first off, the victims, those who victimize the victims, community elders. Elders are, of course, a large facet of Native tradition in Canada.
This thing, it's a tradition of how they used to deal with justice before Europeans.
Essentially, they get together, talk about it, and try to come to a consensus as to how to deal with the fallout. So I don't think that's bad. I think there are certain problems with the idea, such as using coercion to essentially enforce the decision. But honestly, the decision being arrived at by consensus, coercion may not be the biggest part of that.
Yeah.
in the end. Honestly, it just seems like a good
idea. Criminals in the situation, the person who was the perpetrator, are they respecting of the community circles? Do they generally say, well, these are my peers and my elders and the people I depend on for social interaction? So does that become more of a thing for them to respect than, say, this massive state apparatus that's very Kafka-esque and that you don't really have any personal connection with?
My goodness, Nima, I love loaded questions. That was very well done. essentially, yes, of course. You know, it's much easier to respect a community sentencing circle because these are your peers. These are people that you have to deal with day to day. And also, it simply is not an outside force that is determining how you are to pay for your crimes, how you are to be dealt with. You have input as to how you are dealt with, and it's real input. It's not simply going to a judge and groveling. It's going to your peers and negotiating.
Yes, exactly. Negotiating.
So yeah, absolutely. It is a process that is much more respected by the people involved. Unfortunately, people outside of that process in this country typically do not respect it because it is not the status quo. It is not the justice system, if we're going to refer to it as that. I think there are certain qualities of it that are fantastic. And the more removed it is from the state justice system, the courts, I think probably the better. While we've got a bit of time here, and in the interest of preserving time, I'm going to move on to something a tad bit more lighthearted. Ed, as you know, I've recently purchased a rear-wheel drive car.
Yes.
Which was a really smart move in Saskatchewan, as we've recently, in the last couple of weeks, had what? A record-breaking snowfall.
Yes, we've had a couple, a foot and a half or something like that.
Yeah, I remember the loading docks at our workplace there, the snow was right up to the dock plate. I mean, you could have waited in the stuff and been up to your neck. Those snow drifts were incredible. But essentially, we've got lots of snow in Saskatchewan. Nima, not really sure about Austin, Texas. Do you guys get many flakes down there?
None at all. No.
Well, okay.
It's been hot and sweaty and humid as usual. Every now and then, we do get a few flakes, like once every two or three years. When I was a freshman in college, you know, there was this crazy snowstorm out of nowhere, and there was a crazy snowball fight on like the biggest dorm on campus, and it was a ton of fun. But of course, nobody knew how to drive in the snow because nobody ever does that. And so I actually did get in an accident. I don't believe it was my fault because this lady sort of spun out on the freeway. She was sideways across it and I crested the hill, and by the time I saw her, there's nothing I could do because, you know, it's a 2-lane freeway with barricades on either side. Unfortunately, I was on my way to the Adult Video Megaplex XX. and so when the cop asked me where I was going, I had to be honest with him and not commit perjury. And in fact, I didn't have anything for him to write the ticket on, so I gave him the DVD case that I rented.
Oh my, that had to be an entertaining point of justice.
Right, it was. But I do have experience driving in the snow because I did spend, you know, years in Wyoming and Washington State. Right. And my dad lives in Salt Lake, so I go visit him. Although I don't drive much when I'm in Salt Lake. But I used to drive back and forth from Salt Lake to Riverton and Casper, Wyoming. And there's this place called South Pass that is very horrible and gets lots of snow. And there's like death dealing cliffs on either side of the road. And so I've had my fair share of doing that kind of stuff, too.
Well, what about you, Jared? I assume you're essentially trapped indoors, snow probably up to the roof. I'm guessing. Is that just kind of the situation in Winnipeg right now?
No, it's not that bad. We've had quite a bit of snow. It's rained quite a bit, so we got a lot of ice right now.
Oh gosh.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, well, that's always great to have rain to freeze under the snow. It makes for great driving conditions.
Okay, that's usually what happens in Winnipeg.
The reason that I'm going after the course is not simply to talk weather, although I'd love to talk weather all day with Nima and Jared, wonderful fellows. Maybe not so much Ed, but we'll get to that later. Okay, so but the reason that I'm trying to frame this is winter snow tires. Now, in Saskatchewan and also other provinces in Canada, the debate does come up every so often. Should snow tires be required by law? In the province of Quebec, our favorite province, Loopy Quebec, snow tires are required by law. People must equip their vehicles.
Required.
Yes, they must equip their vehicles at certain times of the year with winter driving tires. In parts of British Columbia, also required.
That's true. I knew that, yeah.
Now, generally, though, across Canada, it is a choice. I don't believe it should be required. We'll get into that. But Jared, I'll start with you. What say you? Do you think that, first off, winter driving tires are a good choice for your vehicle in the winter months in Canada? And also, should they be required on people's vehicles?
The winter tires themselves they're good. Like they allow you to stop sooner on ice and stuff like that. However, being mandatory, like, I don't believe that it should be mandatory because a lot of it plays into people's driving. Winter tires tend to give people the feeling of invincibility, so they drive all, like, you see a lot of people with them driving pretty willy-nilly on the roads, and then all of a sudden, you know what I mean? Like, you still can't stop with them. Like, you can't slam on your brakes and expect to stop with them. Yeah, personally, I don't have winter tires on my car, but I drive a front-wheel drive manual transmission, so I don't tend to have a lot of problem braking at all anyways. So.
Right. So what about you, Nima? Do you, I mean, well,
I want to talk about the illusion of the illusion of the illusion safety, of, right?
Okay. What do you think, Ed? Is it an illusion of safety?
Most definitely. Putting guardrails on cliffs makes people drive more erratically. Yeah, having people wear helmets while they're biking makes people think that they're safer than what they really are. Getting people to mandatorily have their, of course, the mandatory thing is just nonsense, but people thinking that they are more invincible when they have supposed more safety put upon them. I think it's a small part, but it's still a part of brains.
I'll come into this in a minute. Nima, what do you think of this illusion of safety?
I kind of see what Ed's getting at there. I think there is some of that, but I also think it's a balance. I mean, at the same time, you do want to have the right tools for the job. You know, I don't think snow tires are a bad thing at all. I never have had them. I've had chains in my trunk in case it gets really bad. And I do drive a tiny little Hyundai that's front-wheel drive and manual transmission, and I'm very good at driving it. I think no matter what tools you have, it's still up to the driver to be careful and be good at what they do. And if you're not used to driving in the snow, be very careful. It's very different. And if you're really bad at it, stay home. You know, let somebody else drive. My philosophy when driving in the snow is I try to minimize any kind of overt input on the car. You know, I don't slam on the brakes, don't turn hard, don't gas hard. I treat it as if I'm a sled and I'm just sort of nudging it to the left or to the right. And I've been in some pretty horrible snowstorms and lived to tell about it. And sometimes I drive 10 miles an hour if it's really bad. And I don't give two craps about what other people think because it's my safety that I'm concerned with most of all.
Well, in the oil field, I remember having to walk my truck into an approach because I could not see. Well, it was such a terrible blizzard. I was driving a fluid hauling a truck, and I couldn't see in front of me. What I had to do was essentially get down on the go, to put the truck in very first gear so it would go very, very slow, get out of the truck as it was moving to look ahead and find an approach and slowly maneuver it into the approach. And I was stuck there for the night. So, I mean, I've driven in some bad condition, let's say. But I on the illusion of safety, I think that we've talked about the illusion of safety before on this show, traffic signs. We've talked about naked intersections with no traffic signs, basic rules. So I agree with the illusion of safety, but I think that winter tires and people's responses to winter tires driving more erratically because they believe they are safer is proof positive that these things do make a difference. So it's about education. And getting people to understand how to use those tools that they have. As Nima said, having the right tools for the job. Now, how do you do that? I think this is where I wanted to go with this.
Yes.
How do you do that? And I think we've arrived here at a different path than I had expected. But I think the way you get people to do that is to realize the value of driving safely. And how do you get people to realize the value of driving safely? Well, you let the insurance market work. Now, if people are told, first off, I'm going to give you a break on your insurance premiums if you equip your vehicle with winter tires. And also, if you get into fewer accidents, I will also give you a further break. I won't charge you a deductible. Dash cams. Maybe if an insurance company says, hey, I'll give you a cheaper insurance if you put a dash cam on your car. These are all potentials, right? So, Jared, what do you think of the insurance motivation? Do you think I'm on the right track?
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, especially for a free society, insurance should be everybody should go to their insurance company, and then they'll tell them whether or not they'll be, you know what I mean, covered for these things. And like I said, if you put a dash cam in so we can see how you drive, we can see how fast you drive, we know that you're not You know what I mean? You're not at fault for any of these accidents or winter tires, so that we know that you're going to be safer on the road, even though you drive safer. Things like that. Yeah, for sure.
What about you, Nima? Insurance obviously doesn't matter. That's what you think, right?
Sometimes. No, I think that's a great idea, and it's a good point. If the cost could be offset, I mean, then you wouldn't really have an excuse, right? I can't say, well, I'm too broke to go buy the snow tires. Because if the insurance company is going to notice that I don't have snow tires or somehow find that out and charge me a higher premium, which, you know, in a free society, I think they'd be well within their means, especially if it – I mean, well, obviously it would have to be in the contract when I signed it. But yeah, if there could be some kind of economic incentive to wear snow tires, or an economic disincentive that was, of course, market driven, you know, then that would be the way to solve the problem, I suppose.
Well, that's, you make the point, right? An economic market based incentive rather than a government incentive, because that's
right.
I think that when these incentives come from the market, then people respond to them properly. And when they come from government, people don't respond to them properly. And the reason for that, this is not simple ideology. The reason for that is because when government imposes an incentive, it is often a universal incentive. Mm-hmm. It may be means tested. It's very defined. So people who may not normally respond to an incentive are given an incentive by government, for example. So then they decide, well, you know, that's, I'm sorry, I'm not explaining this well, but it is a distortion of the market.
When usually government decisions are win-lose, right? It's
pretty much.
Both parties, one party is usually losing and one party is gaining.
Well, like, okay, let's take, for instance, here in Saskatchewan, we have a universal public insurer for automobiles.
Yes.
So in Saskatchewan, we have the Saskatchewan
really?
Government Insurance Corporation.
It's oh, pretty normal, too, up here.
Yes, in Manitoba, you have Manitoba Public Insurance.
Yeah.
And in British Columbia.
In British Columbia,
they have
Ontario?
ICBC.
What about Ontario? I'm not sure.
Ontario, I believe, is a privatized. Private. Yeah, private yeah. market, but it's not really private. It's of course, cartelized.
And Quebec, can we really say Quebec, I'm sure?
Quebec has a mix of public-private.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. My heart skipped a beat, Ethan. Are you kidding me?
anyhow, what I'm getting to is, let's take the Saskatchewan example. Let's say that the government here did, in fact, offer a reduction in insurance premiums should you equip your vehicle with winter tires. How do we know that incentive would be properly presented, because there's only one insurer here. There's nobody to compete mm-hmm. with that insurer and say, I can actually offer even a lower premium, or I can come up with a different mechanism for offering insurance rates in a more unique fashion.
See, Ethan, the great thing about government insurance is the risk is spread over everybody, no demographics at all. So it's all good.
Oh, government insurance, you're so dreamy.
Everyone's insurance is just going to go up that tiny little bit and everyone is protected.
Yeah. Well, you know, it sounds good on paper.
Oh, it does. Of course.
Yeah, but it's when you start thinking about it that's bad.
You're 100% right that then the problem is that the insurance company in that case, when it's a government monopoly insurance company, is that the prices they come up with, the rates they come up with, aren't necessarily market driven. So you don't know if they're the true incentive or not. The other problem I see with government impositions like you must be forced to buy snow tires is it sort of creates a false market then for snow tires, right? Mm-hmm. I don't see why snow tire sellers would then up the price and be like, well, you got to get them. The government says so. You're going to have to buy them one way or the other. So it seems like the price would be upped by something like that.
In fact, in the first when Quebec first imposed the snow tire law, there was a shortage of snow tires across Canada, and the prices did skyrocket. It was hilarious. One yeah. province with about a quarter of the country's population yeah. screwed everything up
for everybody right. else.
So, Jared, any final thoughts on this topic before we end off panel today?
No, I think everybody's pretty much in agreement that it's not like government mandatory things are not not something that we want at all, and government insurance sucks.
Yep. Eloquent, Jared. That's why we have you here. And Nima, what about yourself? Any final thoughts to round us out here?
Yeah, my final thought on the road thing or the snow tire thing is it doesn't seem like it would really be a question that we would be debating like this if it was a private road system or a free market or a market road system. Because then if the road owner says, well, sorry, to gain entrance to the road or to drive on the road during these seasons, you must wear snow tires. Well, that's just his private property's rules. I mean, we don't get that upset when a fine dining establishment requires us to wear a suit jacket to dinner. It's along the same lines. So and then maybe again there'd be a competing road or a competing way of traveling to where you wouldn't have to have those. I don't know how
flying cars.
I don't know if people would frequent those things, but that's, again, for the market to decide. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. Maybe we would just have normal roads like we have now, like the government has. Maybe not. Maybe there'd be flying cars, yeah, and zeppelins and jet packs that are inserted rectally. I don't know.
Oh, goodness. All right. Well, that's another South Park episode, isn't it? No, never mind. Okay. So, of course, predictably, Nima, of course, rounds out panel by opening up another avenue of discussion, appealing to my lack of discipline. But let's end it here because we've already done a terrible job of preserving time. So, Nima, thank you very much for your voice today. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on panel. I hope we have you back at some point.
I hope so, too. It was awesome. Thanks so much, guys.
For sure. And Jared, thank you very much for coming back on. We need to chat more often.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
So to our panelists, of course, thank you once again. And to all of you out there, thank you. We're going to move on to an interview with Jeremy Maddock about property forfeiture laws in Canada. What's going on with that? I'm looking forward to this. This is something we should have addressed sooner, but we are finally getting to it. Only one show a week, Ed. That's the problem.
That's all we got. All we got time for.
All right. So for this week, this has been our fantastic panel with fantastic people and also our panelists. So, yeah, great. Okay, this is Ed and Ethan.